It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Kaleidoscope Gallery. I'm your host, Paul Edwards, and alongside contributors Dave, Leah, and Hans, we will be exploring the story of the Mars One Project. Colonizing Mars, psychedelics and the stoned ape theory, and near-death experiences. So let's step into the first exhibit inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
As a child, my bucket list had just two things: to be a doctor and to be an astronaut.
Mankind deserves to be a multi-planet species. We may be talking about the future of our race.
I wanted to go to Mars ever since I was a little kid.
Colonizing Mars would be the next giant leap for humankind, the next challenge in our quest to understand our nearest neighboring planet.
We have to move, we have to explore, and Mars is the first step.
Mankind's next step lies in space.
I believe it is time for the human species to look forward to a new colony, and I believe that that place that we should look forward to should be Mars.
The clip you just heard was from a promotional video for the Mars One Project, a failed attempt to recruit volunteers / contestants to journey to Mars and start a colony, never to return home to Earth. Organizers of Mars One hoped that some of the funding for the $6 billion project would be generated through some high-profile investors, but mostly from a planned reality TV show where the world could watch the would-be astronauts compete for their place on the rocket and win the one-way ticket to Mars. But the reality show never materialized, and the entire project eventually crumbled, unable to raise anywhere near enough money to pull off such an ambitious plan. Yet right now, there are serious, realistic, and ongoing efforts to colonize Mars. For example, SpaceX CEO Elon Musk says his company will land humans on Mars in 4 years from now. But with colonizing Mars, there comes many challenges. Life on Mars would be hard. And what motivates our desire to colonize Mars and move towards the goal of becoming a multi-planetary species? To explore this exhibit inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery, we are joined by contributors Dave and Leah.
I was going to ask you if you had heard of the Mars One Project. Do you remember that? It started in 2012 and it finally fizzled out in 2019.
I have heard of that. In fact, I really wanted to join because it did sound like an excellent opportunity to be on reality TV and go to Mars for the price of one. And they claimed they were going to pay you, right? But, you know, right now people are lining up to pay Elon Musk like $250 million to get on that first ship. Oh, and Richard Branson's going too. Have you seen his Battlestar Galactica? Starship America? No, Starbase, American Starbase One or whatever it is in the desert. I don't know if the boats actually go in the sky, but it's a really cool looking spaceport. But Elon Musk is doing a fucking great job getting things into space. Sometimes they explode, but he's going into space. That's no one's doing that these days.
Yeah.
Mars is where it's at. And it when it shines, it's red light down you, and you're like, I want to go there and live in a weird silver habitat and grow potatoes and not be able to go outside without wearing a silver outfit. And only Elon Musk has the super like streamlined outfit with the jetpacks, and he's like cruising around outside. Is he even going
to
go?
If Elon Musk's colony that he wants to put on Mars is successful, would it be like proprietary? So when like he'd be kind of like the god of Mars, or the, you know, the ultimate president of Mars or something, you know, because you'd have to, like, if you wanted to, you know, every 10 years when they send along the replacement equipment is obviously going to be all Tesla stuff. Like, you want to talk about Apple? Try Tesla on Mars.
Oh, it's going to be nuts. He's going to own every bank, every convenience store.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, you're going to be saying, where are we going for dinner tonight? It's going to be Elon's Steak Palace. Oh, yeah. Or did you mean Elon's, like, Italian bistro? It's going to be like living on some giant resort, Disney World. But that's what Facebook became. I went there. I went onto that campus, and it was like Disney World. And there were, like Mark Zuckerberg's favorite taco place had been, a franchise was opened. That kind of shit's going
to
happen.
Yeah, so that's, like Mars would be a great staging ground to have your own, like, industrial campus, like, beyond, you know, the realms of human possibility.
I think it makes sense to know how to get there and be confident we could get there and have a few settlers, you know, live in a pod and make it a reality show and entertain the hell out of everybody. Even though probably most of them will die.
Yeah, apparently that was the Mars One. That was a kind of a disclaimer, like warning, chances of dying are high. And also they weren't allowed to have sex with each other when they got there.
That's that upped their chance of dying by at least 20%. But I do think, like overall, the idea of being ready to leave the planet makes some degree of sense.
Well, I mean, if we're going to become a multi-planet species, just in the sense of, like, you know, we develop propulsion that can take us to those other Earth-like planets that are, like, you know, or not propulsion, but space travel technology that can take us those vast distances to those Earth-like planets. Like, why not? I'd go check one out and live there or whatever.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I would go to Mars too. Like, if
it's going to be a very rough and ready start, and like most human beings might not even be able to survive the psychological stress.
Well, at the very least, it's good practice for when we can get to the good ones. But no, I think there's more to Mars than we know, for sure. Like, we sent like a couple of robots to land in a couple of spots, and they're cruising around and they see a lot of dust. But no one's, like, you know, brought out the flugelhorns and started playing a tune and see what rises up out of the sand. And you might not like what you find there. Like, it might just be like giant monsters that are still able to live in that environment.
I know, but the kind of like disappointing part of it is it's not going to be anything like that. The planet is really boring.
Dead, yeah. It's dead planet. But it is a valid, I think it's worthy to human endeavor in that it's a good practice and it's pushing us forward. I see a lot of good in it too.
Yeah. And yeah, I agree with you completely. And maybe it's just a bit of like an Instagram opportunity for the billionaires. It's just kind of an image.
If that's what it takes to, like, start advancing space exploration, I'm all for it. Because we need to up our game on that ship so that we can get out there into the wide world. There's a much wider world. Imagine how many more people would be able to enter the Kaleidoscope Gallery if we added 7 or 9 other civilizations to our fucking friendship.
Yeah, that'd be an expansion of your social media network.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine how many more Facebook friends, Instagram followers. I don't know, man. It's all a rigged scam.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
But does it not make sense that we should, you know, begin to try? So if we should go ahead and try to colonize Mars, why not? How are we going to learn to, you know, it's a baby step.
Mm-hmm. I guess the big question is why? What's the motivation? And so if the motivation is the backup planet, I think we need to put a lot more resources into the problems we have on our planet. And we have a lot of really intractable challenges when it comes to climate, and you know, energy is a subset of that. I mean, it's a huge subset. How we generate energy is probably the, you know, one of the biggest things, fossil fuels, and what's the alternative? It's a big factor. Anyhow, so much more resource, attention, expertise, wisdom, brilliant minds, investment. If we could be putting it into working together to try to solve the problems we have here and be able to live in stewardship of this planet and in some balance and sustainably, so that any space exploration we're doing is not out of fear and scarcity and desperation, but it's out of curiosity and wonder. I mean, we can't continue to be exploitative in our minds. You know, we've colonized each other and we've colonized the planet. And if we continue in our patterns, we'll do it to the point where we may not be able to sustain ourselves on it anymore. It'll go on and it'll change and it'll be fine. Planet doesn't need us, but for us to thrive on it, as we have, requires certain conditions. And so for us to put the resources into that would be, I think, amazing. And I can see the wonder and the desire to live in space and to explore space.
To be a multi-planet, to be an interplanetary or multi-planet species.
Yeah, absolutely. But I feel like, you know, that work should be done in with a spirit of humility and wonder, and not a spirit of like, okay, well, yeah, we can't solve the problems we have on this planet, so we better get off of it.
Do you think that presently we need to focus more on our earthly problems, put more resources towards that, say less towards war, and should not be motivated out of fear or scarcity, but should be motivated out of sort of a unified goal of humanity to become that interplanetary species?
Yeah, to explore, not to conquer, to learn, not to, you know, not to be empire, or not to be, you know, well, like we can't live where we were anymore, so we have to take over some other place. It should be in the spirit of learning and wonder, and yes, we should deploy far more resources and require more of ourselves, because it's not just about resources, it's not just about technology, our problems on our planet. It's mostly about ourselves and what we believe to be true and how we talk with each other and have relationships with each other and whether we trust each other and what we consider to be important. So yeah, I would like to see us do better as a species and, to return more to our stewardship roles, just to re-embrace a little bit of humility and figure out how to be less in conflict. But do I want to go to space? Do I want to travel to other? Absolutely. That would be great.
So listeners, would you have signed up to the Mars One Project, an attempt to win a one-way ticket to Mars as its first colonizers?
The psychedelic experience is a voyage inside. a trip into the countless galaxies of your own nervous system. For thousands of years, philosophers and poets have told mankind that there is more inside, that the reality of the external world is only one of millions of realities within the human nervous system. For thousands of years, too, men have studied methods of consciousness expansion, techniques for going out of your mind. Chemicals are perhaps the most effective method because the language of the body, the language of the nervous system, is itself biochemical.
In his book, Food of the Gods, the philosopher Terence McKenna proposed an idea he termed the Stoned Ape Theory, in which he suggests that the transformation from humans' early ancestors, Homo erectus, to the species Homo sapien, mainly had to do with the addition of the psychoactive mushroom, Psilocybe cubensis, into its diet. At higher doses, he argues, these psilocybin mushrooms would have been the, quote, evolutionary catalyst to language, imagination, the arts, religion, philosophy, science, and human culture in general. Further, McKenna posited that psychedelics allow access to levels of reality that otherwise are invisible to us, and that the experience of these higher realities impart actual useful information about underlying reality. He called these experiences true hallucinations. While many cultures have been using psychedelic plants as medicine and shamanic tools for thousands of years, it was in the 1960s that psychedelics became a counterculture movement in the West, with proponents like Dr. Timothy Leary, whose hypnotic voice you heard in the opening clip, encouraging people to try psychedelics, not only because of its cultural and mind-expanding potential, but also the apparent positive effect on mental health. If psychedelic experience played a role in human evolution in the past, can it still today? Can psychedelics unlock layers of reality that we can rely on as accurate information? To discuss this, we take another trip inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery with Dave and Hans.
Here's what I'd say. When I've been on acid, I've almost always seen fractals. When I close my eyes at night when I'm super high, I almost always see fractals. And yet, the whole world is made of fractal geometry. And you can see it when you zoom out on Google Maps. You can see it when you look at a leaf and then you look at the tree and you like the. And there's an amazing documentary on PBS called Hunting the Hidden Dimension. So basically what they look at is these irregular repeating shapes, which are found in the cloud formations and the tree limbs and the stalks of broccoli and the craggy mountain ranges and the rhythm of the human heart, and as well in like cheesy screensavers and acid hallucinations that somehow that hidden dimension is opened up, because for centuries these fractal irregular shapes, they were considered, you know, beyond the boundaries of mathematical understanding.
Yeah.
But now we know.
Yeah.
The whole world is made of fractals. Like, just zoom out on Google Maps, and if you go into satellite mode, it's like it's the same fractals that you saw.
Or if you look at some of the Hubble pictures of a nebula and how it looks like an eye, like a human eye, or and the underlying Fibonacci numbers of the mathematical rules in which nature emerges
and operates.
And when you're saying, and I actually will concur, that a psychedelic experience can let you almost see those building blocks of that Fibonacci nature, the fractal nature of our reality, which kind of suggests that reality isn't something that's just in our mind. It's out there, and you can access it.
Mm-hmm. The future is jagged.
Part of the reason why I this topic fascinates me is because I have had actually some incredible experiences. For example, if I can share with you one. So, like I say, I was kind of a bit into this, but not recreationally. Is a little bit more. Yeah, I wanted to really experience and experiment with psychedelics and, you know, the doors of perception, which you were kind of referring to. And
yes.
My friend and I, we kind of developed, we were like each other's, we were kind of like trip partners. And so we would be each other's like lookout and create contexts that were good for taking acid in. So
now would one of you trip and one of you look out, or you'd both trip together? And hope one of you weren't flipping at the same. You both were both flipping at the same time.
That it's exactly that, and that worked out really well, actually. But what he had done is, my friend had on another acid trip with another person who was, again, like kind of like, you know, consciously dropping acid to see what would happen together. Had heard from someone else a technique that while you're tripping, if you do this technique, you will have a particular kind of hallucination. And whoever does this technique will also experience this hallucination. So you can have a group hallucination.
Really? That sounds very interesting. And did you try that?
Yes. And it worked. So he had learned a technique. So first of all, you wait and you take the acid at the same time. It takes a couple of hours before you start peeking on it. And at that time, and you know when you're there, you begin this kind of ritual or method. And the method was quite an ancient method. It was basically focusing on your breathing. And you focus on your breathing with the goal to slow your heartbeat down. You know? So anyway, what would happen after a very short amount of time? Something appeared, and my friend said, "Do you see it? Do you see the river of light?" And yeah, I did. A river of light appeared in the room, flowing, and it was so beautiful, and it flowed through my body, out into infinite space. And my heart was beating, doom-doom, doom-doom, very, very slowly. Kind of maybe like a yogi might do. And this river of light, it kind of was pulling out my life force and gently coaxing me to join this river of light. And there seemed to be beings, people, but they were light beings, and they were encouraging me to let my soul go. As it was at that moment, and my friend was enthralled with it, it's at that moment I realized, well, I've used LSD to get to a place that maybe I shouldn't really be yet. Because what it was for me, I sensed that it was what happens to your soul when you die.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what it sounded like. You It was the light at the end of the tunnel, the golden light that they say you see when you're on the way in to be out again, or out to get back in again.
Yeah, you got to get in to get out. To quote someone, but the idea of guided hallucination, guided psychedelic hallucination can take you to, can reveal information in a true hallucination.
True hallucination is where you actually get instruction from across the 11 dimensions. You get a little view through the membrane, a little disrupted gravitron flow, messaging rolling across the 11, your strings getting that little hit, that vibration that you know means you are feeling something that isn't just one of the feelings that they have on the list.
That sounds to me like super string theory or
Well, I think that they're related.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Yeah, I remember the time that you introduced me actually to the concept of microdosing mushrooms, because it's a thing right now, but I had only really thought of it as something that you go on like a heavy trip with. But you had some that you shared when we were up at the cottage, it's an isolated cottage, and it's quite beautiful, and it's very it's right next to the lake, it's private, like I said. So we did a little bit of these microdose mushrooms, and it was nice. It was quite mild, but it was I remember the clouds looking particularly beautiful, but it was quite sublime.
Yeah. Oh, it felt therapeutic, I think, would be the best, from my experience, at least. Things felt in their place, relaxed, felt very relaxed. Appreciation for nature, beauty, a little, yeah. But nothing, it wasn't disorientating or... I didn't feel nervous or anything.
I concur. That's exactly my experience. Although I am a little bit more used to higher doses, but in the higher doses, there is almost every time still that nervousness or maybe trepidation that you might have taken too much, or, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe you're in the wrong circumstance. You know, you do it and you're like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best idea tonight. I forgot that Auntie Mabel was coming over.
Yeah, you never know until it happens. But those experiences, you learn a lot too. Whether it's you appreciate your mind and not being fucked up. There's that relief too, right?
Yeah.
If you're like too gnarled up, and then you really are not enjoying the circumstance, and then when all is said and done and you like return back to some sense of sanity, you're really appreciative of that state. It's almost like we got through it, and that's where like the good feeling comes from, the enjoyment of it sometimes. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that also kind of goes in line with the concept that, well, the way mushrooms work is it's supposedly toxic to your, like, the side effects, the hallucinogenic side effects are actually side effects of similar to a poison, or so. I don't know if it's like, it is kind of like a ritual or a rite in some cultures, like you have to go through some kind of pain or some kind of you know, being walking in the desert for a week alone or whatever. Maybe you go through some kind of
Yeah, it's the same kind of curve with any kind of, like, epiphany thing. It's very, like, condensed thinking, a lot of, problem, like, trying to maybe, like, solve a problem. There's, like, a lot of dense thought, a lot of, like, fixation on, like, one certain troubling emotion, and then it becomes, like, you're as light as air. And it kind of bursts. And then you go back to, like, all the intense emotions. But, yeah, I think it's just, like, a push and pull kind of thing. Taking whatever in high doses, you're going to get that kind of experience. It's like you get the catharsis. You don't get the catharsis without, like, the intensity. Kind of have to go there.
See, the truth is, virtually any experience you can have with psychedelics, you can have without psychedelics, because all psychedelics do is modulate the existing neurochemistry of the brain. They're not doing something that the brain can't do on its own. You're just playing with neurotransmitters or mimicking neurotransmitters. I have had the same experience to more or less similar degree just through meditation. But it's clear to me that I would never have suspected that such an experience was possible but for my experimenting with MDMA in the beginning.
You know that you've heard of ayahuasca?
Yeah, like whatever, like the DMT shit or whatever.
I don't know if the ayahuasca and DMT are chemically related like that. I'm not sure. You might be right. But the point being, having apparently ayahuasca is like a guided shamanic trip in which people report having like really, really deep-seated problems in their psyche revealed to them, which can often perhaps be kind of terrifying. People have described it as very harrowing. But when all is said and done and you return back to some semblance of normalcy, you come back a changed person, a better person, maybe a healed person, or maybe it wears off after a while. I'm not sure. Would you ever try something like that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm really hyper aware of, like, a lot of my flaws, so, like, I don't really know if it would be that productive. Or, like, issues that I have, like, I'm pretty fucking aware of them, so I don't know necessarily if it would be the best thing if I were to do it tomorrow in our current climate. Try to keep things as, like, simple as possible currently, as far as routine and stuff, but
right,
is it useful? Yeah. I mean, but it's like any other thing. Like, people get, there's times where, like, people get addicted to that, like, that epiphany feeling, and then they just, like, people just go back to it, keep going back to it to get, like, there's, like, a difference between it changing your life. Not that I've done it, but they're, like, in these kind of tools, using these tools. There's a difference between it having a positive practical influence, which I think that it's meant to be used for, and then there's it's just people who get obsessed with the feeling, like, regardless if it's chemical or natural, and that evokes a, like, chemicals in the brain, and, like, obviously it does that, but I think there are certain people who just get addicted to the chemical result and not, like, the practicality of, and not incorporating the knowledge that it shows or reveals.
Yeah.
There are all these tools, you know, even pharmaceuticals and not just like plant shit. Like it doesn't. They're all tools. If we are reaching for them in a state of like naive brokenness, searching for something that's gonna be, I don't know, feel something or to escape something, then like try to say like, is there anything that like I can do to like help personally make my life better without these things? But at the same time, I think like using these things are like necessary for some people to like help balance their lives better. Self-awareness of intention is key with that, and evaluating yourself and the reasons for you wanting to do that actually.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Well, more than 90% of people believe there is an afterlife. But what exactly is it? Some people claim they know because they've actually experienced it. They share incredible stories like reconnecting with deceased loved ones or learning the meaning of life. The accounts are vivid and dramatic, but are they imaginary or are they a true glimpse into life after death?
It's transformational. It's awesome.
Pure love, pure joy, pure bliss.
Peace, ecstasy, harmony. There was no fear, there's no hierarchy.
It was just so wonderful.
It was amazing.
The accounts are remarkable and widespread.
And I knew instantly I was in the presence of my creator.
It changed me as a person.
This life is not all there is.
It was really life-changing to have that near-death experience.
The feeling like nothing she'd ever known.
There was this feeling of a presence that was next to me. It felt like it was God. It felt so loving and so accepting and so eternal. I just began calmly talking to it and saying how much I wanted to go back into my life because my baby daughter was only 5 months old at the time.
Pledging to make changes in her life, Barbara says she was suddenly back. It was striking. From that moment on, she was filled with love, peace, and purpose.
The loss of fear of death is so amazing.
Philosophers, scientists, and religious thinkers have long debated the act of dying. Is it a passing or a crossing over to the other side? Or is it merely a chemical reaction within the brain? In a handbook for hospice professionals, whose mission it is to care for the terminally ill in their last days of life, practitioners are advised that, quote, visual or auditory hallucinations are often part of the dying experience. The appearance of family members or loved ones who have died is common. The dying may turn their focus to, quote, another world, and talk to people or see things that others do not see. These visions are considered normal, unquote. Upon his final moments of life, hardcore rationalist Steve Jobs is said to have exclaimed, "Oh wow, oh wow." His family reported he was looking, quote, elsewhere as he spoke. And some indigenous cultures have a practice somewhat akin to a, quote, death midwife, grounded in indigenous customs, that involves communicating to ancestors and performing ceremonies, such as the traveling ceremony, designed to pave the way of a deceased person's road to the afterlife. So is the death experience like entering into a reunion with loved ones who are on the other side? Is there a tunnel of light with a loving deity at the end of it? Is it beauty beyond words? Or is it a flickering of electrical impulses, soothing brain chemicals, and then darkness? And what can we learn about the death process from listening to the stories from people who have had near-death experiences? To reflect on these ponderous questions, we are joined once again by Kaleidoscope Gallery contributor, Leah.
I've recently listened to a docudrama on near-death experiences, and people talk about there's consistent patterns, there's unique experiences, but sort of somewhat consistent patterns that seem to happen throughout them. But there's an experience of timelessness where there's also an experience, it seems, of sort of different form of space where you can see everything. So you can see what's happening to your body, but also to loved ones. You're able to see things that you wouldn't be able to see in you know, inside of your body normally.
So this is people who have experienced what they would call
near-death experiences.
So they've come to kind of the precipice point of
they have died. They have been clinically dead, and then they have been resuscitated in varying lengths of clinically dead. But also people who study it, who've been studying it for 40 years and the sort of thing. So in this docudrama, all these different people are being interviewed.
They're able to share their experience of what it's like to basically die. And so this is as close as we're going to get and to understanding this.
To understanding death. And so they experience, there's consistent patterns. So that's one of the things that they, in the first phase, is sort of this above your body, seeing everything that's going on. And sometimes even being able to see beyond that, right? So, and then there's being greeted by loving beings that are often being described as ancestors, sometimes specific ones like father or uncle that passed away or et cetera, right? But grandmother, and loving sense of embrace, then usually some form of journey, sometimes different sensory color, light, flowers, smell, and then for some who have been passed away for quite some time, like there was one woman who had been dead for probably about 30 minutes or so. It's the fact wow. She came alive again is just, yeah, all just impossible. But anyways.
And this is all backed by medicine. These are
no, this woman is a physician herself. Yes. Yeah, so, but she, for her, because she was dead for so long, she continued the journey all the way, you know, ancestors did, traveling with her, warm embrace, beautiful, like not in body, not in pain, nothing, you know, nothing like that. So arrival at a she sort of describes as a domed place that, you know, she felt like home, you know. But in all of these people, because there's near-death experiences, at some point in this journey, usually earlier on for most people, the ancestors, loved ones journeying with you would turn to them and say, okay, no, it's not your time. You have to go back to your body. And so they journey back to their body, and then they get resuscitated, and then they have to be in pain and live their lives. And they're changed by their experience forever. And it seemed for many of them, they struggled because they felt like they were crazy, because our culture doesn't recognize this. And, you know, certainly.
Because we live in obviously a science dominated society,
Western science,
then obviously they're going to reject it. And it's true. They just kind of want to reduce it to, like it's our body giving us something soothing. Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the chemicals aren't working anymore, right? So the brain is no longer receiving oxygen. Like these people, like to varying degrees, have been clinically dead. And they're still describing, you know, having ongoing experiences that are consciousness continuing, even after the body is clinically dead. And that's being acknowledged by those who are studying this phenomenon.
Our consciousness surviving beyond our body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there being a journey that's in some ways consistent with kind of the mythology that we have, the archetype, the stories, the true stories we tell ourselves, different cultures about death, whether it's, you know, traveling on the river Styx, you know, to the final destination.
A bright light's come up a lot.
Also, so does water. So people see oceans, right? So that's, again, the river, the concept of the river and merging with the ocean, or which is very common symbolism and, for death and for the journey into the after, the other world.
Well, that's interesting because earlier in the episode, I was describing a psychedelic experience that I had that could be described as seeing the river of life, or that river Styx that you were talking about, which is the, you know, a flow of life. I don't know how to describe it. I tried to describe it earlier, so hopefully I did a good job of that. But I think I have actually possibly seen that myself.
Yeah, sure. You probably have. It relates back to our earlier conversation, right? So people use drumbeat, smudge, hallucinogenic substances, meditation, etc., to be able to you know, to be able to access that flow, interact with that, and even to be able to feel that sense of merging the river with the ocean.
Merging the river with the ocean. This is a topic we will definitely explore further in coming episodes. But before we part, let me share these words from medieval Persian poet Rumi. On the day I die, when I'm being carried toward the grave, don't weep. Don't say, "He's gone, he's gone." Death has nothing to do with going away. The tomb looks like a prison, but it's really a release into union. The human seed goes down to the ground like a bucket into the well. It grows and comes up full of some unimagined beauty. Your mouth closes here and immediately opens up with a shout of joy there. I hope you have enjoyed this excursion through the Kaleidoscope Gallery. Until next time, and remember, keep it surreal.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.